This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening to An Hour of Disruptions. That's right. From disruptive changes in higher education that could make the college experience of the future unrecognizable to the alumni boosters of today, to disruptions in law enforcement from a Supreme Court decision yesterday. What is self-incrimination when your own DNA can turn you in? And with the disruptive effects of social media, kids, we learn, are inventing their own forms of privacy. But first to a trial that's all about disrupting governmental privacy, the power to declare things secret. In many ways, the trial of Army Private Bradley Manning, which began this week, will be a trial of the United States government. Those powers of secrecy and the government's ability to control information regarding matters of national security. It will also be the most public showcase yet for a very disturbed young man who has reportedly suffered during many months of imprisonment and isolation since his arrest on espionage charges more than 3 years ago. But Manning may have already won his broader case against the U.S. government. He claimed his purpose in leaking documents was to spark a domestic debate over the role of the military and our foreign policy in general. By compelling the government to justify its policies of secrecy before a judge in open court, Manning has forced that debate on the government. An open debate that was always part of Manning's original rationale in giving secret documents to WikiLeaks in the first place. This trial, in short, will be like no other. But motions, briefs, and transcripts of pretrial hearings have not been made public. The government is fighting to keep virtually all of the proceedings secret. And joining us now for more on the attempts to keep the public away from this trial is Shana Kadidal, who is a senior managing attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Shana, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
In a sense, the whole idea of secrecy is what's on trial here, aside from Bradley Manning himself.
That's right. One of the interesting things about this trial is that journalists who were covering a trial like this, if it were happening in ordinary federal district court, would have access to the transcripts of the daily proceedings to check their notes every day when they're writing their stories. They would have access to the parties' briefs before they stepped into court so they could read them ahead of time and understand what the parties were arguing about. And then they would have access to the judge's decisions when she issued orders on important issues in the case so they could read those documents and write their stories accordingly. But in Bradley Manning's court-martial, which started this week, the journalists trying to cover it don't have access to any of those things. The judge has not allowed any of those documents to be published. And the strange thing is that it's not because any of the content in these documents is classified or secret in any other way that making them public would threaten national security. Instead, the judge has just decided she doesn't have to publish any of the documents. So when she issues an order, for instance, she'll read it out loud in open court. So any of us who can squeeze into the courtroom can sit there and listen to it. But she won't give the actual document out to the journalists. So the journalists sitting in the press room are, you know, comparing notes frantically as the judge reads these orders out. Sometimes it takes 2 hours at a time, going at 180 words a minute. And, you know, just as a practical matter, it makes it kind of impossible for journalists to cover this very complex trial in a responsible and accurate manner.
Well, what steps have already been taken to try to open this trial, including steps that your organization has taken?
Well, sure. So the the pretrial proceedings have been going for more than a year, and we started as far back as last March by writing letters to the judge saying, you know, look, this is a ridiculous situation, and the First Amendment, which guarantees open access for the public and the press to the courtroom itself, also similarly guarantees access to the significant judicial documents that are filed in a case. And of course, the judge didn't think that was the case. She told us that we could just go request the documents through the Freedom of Information Act, probably after the trial was over. And so we went up to the military courts of appeals. We spent 2 months in the Army Court of Criminal Appeals. They rejected our claims with a one-sentence order that had no explanation. So 5 days later, we appealed to the Supreme Court for the courts martial in the United States, the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. And we argued that case in October. And then the court sat on it for 6 months and then finally issued a 10-page decision, very short decision, a few weeks ago that said, you, the media, and members of the public, you don't have the right to even set foot in this courtroom and argue for access to the documents. Even if the judge decided to shut the courtroom doors for no rational reason, you know, with no issues of secrecy or classified information at stake, we couldn't do anything about it. So that's why a few days ago we filed a lawsuit in federal district court in Baltimore seeking access again to these documents.
And this is really very much about the specialized nature of the military courts. It's not the whimsy of one particular judge. It sounds like the Pentagon does not want this Manning trial to change any sort of procedural precedent in terms of access to the public to military courts.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The issue of access to the courtroom itself was argued and fought over and decided many years ago. There were a lot of sexual misconduct trials against officers in the late 90s. One of them resulted in a decision called ABC versus Powell that very clearly established that the press can go up in the military courts of appeals and argue for access. But it's a question of documents. It's kind of new. And, you know, it will come up again this year. You know, if we don't win in this case, you know, the Ndal Hassan trial, which will happen in a court martial will probably take place under similarly sort of restrictive conditions of access to documents. That's Ndal Hassan, by the way, the Fort Hood shooter. So it's not just important for this case, but I think you know, one of the important points to take away here is that if you're sitting in the government's position and you want journalists to not cover a case, the worst thing you can do is seal off all access to the case. You know, to tell people they can't even come into the courtroom, because that kind of thing piques the media's interest. But what they've done here is basically just make it extremely difficult as a practical matter to cover the trial. And they've kind of cut off the flow of interesting detail that comes when you get to actually read the parties' briefs and sort of dig into the factual detail of the case that way. And I think that's what you see in this case. You know, it's the most important court-martial trial since Milei. It's the most important case involving government secrets since the Pentagon Papers. And yet for the last year, when we go down to the pretrial proceedings, there are maybe two or three members of the mainstream press there. It's astonishing how little coverage there has been of this case, and I think a lot of it is down to the fact that the rules of access have created kind of this simulacrum of public access.
Finally, do you get a sense that the court will consider the case of Bradley Manning on the terms of the defendant himself, that he will get to argue the kinds of issues that he raised in his rationale and in some of his pretrial statements? Or is it going to be a very hard crackdown on the very specific issues of the leak?
Well, the judge has already ruled that a lot of Manning's political motivations for the leaks can't come in into evidence. You know, so for instance, you know, the very idea that he did this because he saw war crimes and he wanted to report them, or that, you know, like the leaker of the Pentagon Papers, he wanted to show the American public that the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were not going as well as they had been led to believe by our elected officials. You know, those things won't come into this trial at all. And I think in the trial in the Court of Public Opinion, the fact that journalists don't have access to these documents during the trial means that a lot of the information that supports those kind of claims also won't end up being reported on.
Shane Akatadal, Senior Managing Attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
So with considerably less secrecy, President Obama announces three nominations to fill vacancies on the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, what's often called the second most important court in the U.S. But it is a court that has been stalled and stymied by congressional gridlock over judicial appointments of all kinds. The president has chosen a law professor, a lawyer, and a federal judge. Joining us is Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Which are you, the lawyer, the federal judge, or the law professor? Todd, welcome.
Oh, gosh. Neither, but these three nominees, John, have a bigger story than just their own personal bios that involves Harry Reid, Mitch McConnell, the Senate, and the president. And maybe we can get to all that. The lawyer, well, they're all lawyers. The judge is Robert Wilkins. He's a district judge right now with a long history on the court. The private practice lawyer is Patricia Ann Millett, who formerly worked in the Solicitor General's office and has argued more than 30 cases before the Supreme Court herself. And then the law professor is Cornelia Pillard, who teaches at Georgetown University Law Center here in D.C. She's tried 9 cases before the court because she is a former assistant Solicitor General herself.
Is there anything about announcing all three which is trying to stack the deck here?
Well, and that's where it's in the eye of the beholder. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit has 11 members, 11 seats. 8 of those are filled now. There are 3 vacancies. So Obama naming all 3 at one time, he wants to get that court filled. Now, why name them all at once is the question, because that court and many other courts, but that court in particular, is a longstanding bone of contention between Republicans and Democrats in the Senate over the makeup of this court and judicial nominees more more broadly. Republicans, John, want to pass a law that shrinks that court down to the current eight that are on it so that there are no more seats even available. They think that court's too big. They like the balance as it is. Democrats hate the idea. But it also won't come as any surprise to you because you remember the story, John. Remember the nuclear option?
Sure.
The finger hovering over the button? That's what this is about. We have to go back to 2005 when Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, on behalf of the Bush White House, was upset over what they saw as Democratic delay tactics over Miguel Estrada for the U.S. Circuit Court, Patricia Owen, another conservative judge, and the Republicans threatened to change the Senate rules to take away the ability of the minority, back then, the Democrats, to delay these judicial nominations.
Let's just remind people, this is a 60-vote rule issue here, right? This is a big showdown on the 60-vote rule.
To filibuster judicial nominees. There are always struggles between Republicans and Democrats over who gets on the court, sure. But there has been this standoff back since 2004 and this threat to change the Senate rules so that the minority can't block judicial nominees. That's what we might be headed for between Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell. There was a little bit of a ratcheting down, a little bit of a stand down on this very issue, on this very court. Just 2 weeks ago, Harry Reid starting to rekindle his threat to exact the nuclear option, to set it off, change the rules so that Mitch McConnell can't filibuster any judicial nominees. McConnell let one judge go. That judge was Sri Srivastava onto this very U.S. court, Circuit Court for D.C. It now has the three vacancies. Before it had four. That was a little bit of a ratcheting down, but now we might be on a collision course because Reid wants to see how McConnell's going to react to these three judges in addition to a bunch of other administration nominees for cabinet posts.
And there's still weird rules on judicial appointments. Can't a single senator block an appointment with some weird little rule?
No, if courtesies are observed, a single senator can hold a nomination. The majority leader doesn't have to obey that. Usually as a courtesy, they'll hold it until that senator's concerns are met. Technically, well, under the rules, a single senator can't block a nomination. They can certainly slow it down under tradition.
Thanks so much. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks as always.
Sure thing.
Supreme Court this week upheld the practice of taking DNA samples of people arrested in felony cases, even if they're not charged. The ruling, Maryland v. King, was a 5-4 decision. In the majority opinion, Justice Anthony Kennedy called swabbing for DNA a legitimate police booking procedure, like fingerprinting and photographing. But in his passionate dissent yesterday, Justice Antonin Scalia said, "It may be wise, as the court obviously believes, to make the Leviathan all-seeing so that he may protect us all the better. But the proud men who wrote the Charter of our liberties would not have been so eager to open their mouths for royal inspection." "I dissent," said Scalia. DNA is, of course, a TV star, in addition to being just a molecule. On shows like Law & Order, Bones, and CSI, DNA evidence solves cases every night. How much of what we fear about DNA evidence comes from our mythology about it, and how much is hard science? Here with me to explain what it all means for investigations of crime scenes is Gregory Laskowski, criminologist and consultant to the CBS series CSI. Greg, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So can DNA turn us all in if there's a government database available to link us to anything we touch, any place we breathe?
Potentially that could be the case, but I think practically or pragmatically that's not going to really happen. As it stands, only convicted offenders and people who are arrested for major crimes and some misdemeanors, and that's particularly in California, would be subject to having a DNA collection entry into a national database.
Now, is it the case that DNA, if someone swabs your cheek, can just be plugged into some information database and possibly pop up as being involved in a crime that took place 10 years ago?
Well, right now there are currently very strict controls as to how DNA data is entered into these national databases such as CODIS. Law enforcement can collect DNA samples, and then those are presented to a laboratory, currently an accredited laboratory under DNA guidelines or DAB guidelines, and then those samples must go under a rigorous testing procedure before they can be uploaded into the system. So there are criteria for entry into those databases. So not just anyone or anybody can collect the DNA sample and then enter it into a database.
Before DNA, of course, there were fingerprints, and fingerprints had certain weaknesses, even if you got a perfect fingerprint lifted off of a piece of glass, for instance. But there are lots of places where fingerprint evidence is of no help. What are the limitations of DNA evidence, and would you say it's more definitive than our original notions of fingerprinting?
Well, DNA evidence can be more definitive, particularly if you look at in terms of doing straight statistics on all the different loci and alleles that DNA has to offer. It looks much more sound than fingerprints. On the other hand, fingerprints can distinguish between identical twins, whereas DNA cannot. The other aspect of fingerprints and its limitations are is if you have a smudged fingerprint, it is now possible with our DNA technology to perhaps get useful DNA profiles from smudged fingerprints.
Oh, that's interesting. You know, one of the things about this that is ironic to me is as futuristic as DNA evidence seems, and when you watch shows like CSI, there's all the lab equipment and scientific procedures associated with it. I mean, it's really hard to plant a fingerprint on a crime scene. That's really, really difficult. But tossing somebody's DNA onto a crime scene, that's, you know, any idiot can do that.
That might be true. It is very difficult to plant fingerprints, and sometimes when people have attempted to plant fingerprints, that has been discovered. On the other hand, one could leave someone's DNA or smear someone's DNA onto an object without anyone knowing it, and the police could find it. And with the new technologies and I think future technologies, we'll be able to work with smaller and smaller DNA samples and still get robust results.
How regulated, how careful are the labs that deal with this? There's a whole infrastructure built up around DNA identification for various reasons, and there have been some problems.
There have been problems, and there probably are some problems currently, but I would say for the most part, overall, laboratories that provide DNA testing and upload information into DNA databases such as CODIS are under very, very strict guidelines. And those tests are rigorously conducted. There's checks and double checks, and in some cases what I call triple checks, because when a case is conducted and DNA is entered into the databases, there have to be technical reviews. There also have to be administrative reviews, and that's for just the laboratory testing. Then for entry into CODIS, you have to have a CODIS manager who has to meet certain qualifications, and the laboratory has to meet certain accreditation guidelines to even enter this material and then search that material on these databases.
Finally, Greg, you know, Antonin Scalia suggests that Thomas Jefferson might not have been, quote, so eager to open his mouth for royal inspection for a DNA test and would have been outraged by this Supreme Court decision. What do you think Thomas Jefferson would make of DNA testing? You think he'd submit to it? And what do you make of Scalia's dissent?
Well, I find that interesting because I know that Jefferson was somewhat of a scientist and inventor. And I think Jefferson was also interested in justice. And as long as there were strict controls, and even at that time, certain procedures would be followed rigorously, and it was sort of a checks and balance system, I think he would agree to it.
Finally, I can't resist here. Have you ever had to tell those guys at CSI that, no, that's malarkey. You can't do that with DNA.
More than one occasion, that usually happens. Either at CSI or Bones or any of these shows, they can get quite fanciful. You know, the writers, you know, have ideas, and you know, they will go with whatever the science will lead them to.
Well, thanks for holding them back there, Greg.
Thank you.
Gregory Laskowski is a criminologist and consultant to the CBS series CSI. So where do you come down on this? On our Facebook page, Barbara wrote, "My initial reaction is no. Then I remember that everyone arrested gets fingerprinted, and a DNA swab isn't all that much more of an invasion than having your fingerprints entered into a database. And then I remember that although I've never been arrested, my fingerprints are already in a database because I was required as part of a job. A slippery slope indeed." Peter from Rehoboth, Delaware wrote, "Yes, it would potentially free people who were wrongly convicted. It would also find past offenders. I think every state should have it for anyone convicted of a felony." This is coming from an ex-con. I'm all for it. And there were plenty of yikes, no way, wow, shades of 1984s. What do you say, disruption of civil liberties or security precaution? The Supreme Court DNA decision. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation.
Hello? Breakfast for one at 9, please. Green figs, yogurt, coffee, very black. Thank you.
Well, those are the good old days. It is the rare hotel these days that has 24-hour room service for someone like James Bond. The boom in the hotel business in the U.S. right now is in low-cost suite hotels that offer a free buffet breakfast and no restaurant on the premises. If you want food delivered, the front desk will be happy to give you a list of pizza places in the neighborhood. Yes, the grand hotel days have been over for a while, and now one of the holdouts is calling it quits on room service altogether. New York's biggest hotel, the Hilton Hotel in Midtown Manhattan, is canceling its room service for 2,000 rooms. Jacob Tomsky joins us now. He's the author of Heads in Beds, a behind-the-scenes memoir of the hotel industry. Jacob, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
What fond memories do you have of room service, and what's the impact in the hallways of hotels, do you think, of this decision?
It's pretty large. There's a lot of employees on the line here when it comes to room service, more than you'd think. I think initially people consider just the room service attendants, the ones who bring the food, but often there's a dedicated kitchen for room service, dispatch, and people who take the calls and the orders. So it's a pretty big change in the business, and for those at the Hilton, quite a few jobs lost.
And, you know, it's about expectations. With the growth of low-cost hotels, the expectation that you have to have room service goes away, and that's an invitation for hotels to really cut costs.
Absolutely. I mean, we've seen this trend continue on even now with pod hotels. Services are continually shrinking. Sometimes room sizes are shrinking. And it's, you know, the hotel is adapting to the market, and oftentimes service is the first to go.
So what's going to happen to all those trays, those carts? I mean, we're going to be in a landfill somewhere?
No, they'll actually probably sell them. I know for a fact from my time in the business that when a hotel goes through renovation and if they change, you know, the plateware, if they change actually the furniture in the room, then it goes on sale somewhere. So there's a lot of people with hotel things in their house. They might not even know it.
Where is the room service you know, nostalgic 24-hour room service? Where is that alive and well in the world? If it's leaving New York, and there are still hotels where you can do room service, and there probably will be for a while, but everywhere in the world is not like, you know, the strip mall hotels that have the grab-and-go breakfasts.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, New York is one of the homes of room service. I mean, of course, it was invented at the Waldorf Astoria, I believe in the 1930s. And, you know, the Plaza has a wonderful room service, and that will never go away. And one of the reasons it will never go away is because the star rating for the hotel systems, having a 24-hour room service is integral to getting a 4- and 5-star rating, which is very important for a hotel to have. So because of that, hotels have already been sort of putting up with room service to a degree just to achieve these star and diamond ratings. So that will continue.
I love that. Room service was invented at the Waldorf in the 30s. What do you think happened? Oh, couldn't you just bring it up here? I'm so tired. Please, just. And then, wow, we've invented room service.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a huge change. And now, unfortunately, it looks like it's shrinking away.
Most expensive thing you ever ordered, Jacob, before we go?
Well, I was always working at the desk, which I wrote about in Heads in Beds. But, you know, I know there's $10,000 omelets in the city. I know that. Made with caviar, I believe.
All right. Glad to know they exist. Jacob Tomsky, author of Heads in Beds, a reckless memoir of hotels, hustles, and so-called hospitality on the decline, the ending of room service by the Hilton Hotel in Midtown Manhattan. Thanks, Jacob.
Thank you for having me.
There are some crime statistics just out that DNA evidence probably can't explain. According to new federal data, about half of all drug arrests in 2011 and 2010 were for marijuana use. But even though usage rates for marijuana are similar among whites and blacks, black Americans, according to these data, were nearly four times as likely to be arrested for marijuana possession. Joining us is Carl Hart, professor of psychology at Columbia University. He's a drug researcher. He also is author of the forthcoming book, High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery That Challenges Everything You Know About Drugs and Society. Welcome, Carl.
Good to hear from you.
So these data don't really explain anything regarding use patterns. It's an arrest pattern that I'm wondering if what you're seeing here is targeting individual neighborhoods, or if it's just being black means you're more likely to get stopped and frisked and then arrested if you are caught with possession.
Well, as you know, in New York, these numbers are not surprising. We've known this for some time in New York. I think the interesting thing about these data is that it's nationwide, and that's not surprising either. It's just that it's where police put their enforcement efforts in black communities primarily.
And what is the corrective here? I mean, would you expect there to be an increase in arrests in white communities, white neighborhoods, or would a fairer option to basically be to back off on marijuana altogether? It is being decriminalized, if not legalized, in all kinds of places around the U.S.
Well, I think one of the things I try and point out in my book is that a fairer option would be to decrease the arrest for drugs in general. So it's not only marijuana. If we look at other drugs, the same sort of pattern occurs. And so we need to maybe decriminalize all drugs.
What do you think the impact is of having a four times greater rate of arrest probability for blacks versus whites? What's the impact of that on neighborhoods and communities?
Well, we're talking about marijuana arrests here, but if we go across the board with many crimes, we'll see the same sort of pattern occur. So drugs are just one tool, or drug policy is just one tool by which we use in this country to further marginalize black folks.
Yet the federal data here suggests that the federal government and Barack Obama leading the pack here is being more aggressive, not less aggressive, than in dealing with marijuana and drug crime.
Well, that's the case with each president. I mean, before Barack Obama, George Bush was harsher than Clinton. Before Clinton, Clinton was harsher than the Bush previous to him. So the war on drugs just continues to escalate. And so the concern that we all have is when will it end?
And what do you think the cost is of pursuing this particular policy?
Well, the costs are not bared to the same extent by each groups of people. So the cost is primarily bared in this case by black folks. And the cost to them, of course, is that people get blemishes on their records and then they are not allowed to get jobs or they have a decreased likelihood of getting jobs. And so the cost to that community is clear. Now, the cost to other communities like law enforcement, there aren't any costs. In fact, there are benefits because you increase their budgets. They have jobs, a wide range of things. So we need to understand that there are a lot of people who are benefiting from this sort of policy.
The question is, with statistics like this, is there a possibility of a real legal challenge if it can be shown that racial bias is systematically used in deciding whom to arrest for marijuana charges or whom to basically ignore? Carl Hart, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Carl Hart is a professor of psychology at Columbia University. He's a drug researcher and author of the forthcoming book, High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery That Challenges Everything You Know About Drugs and Society. With all of the nostalgia that goes with the experience of college, the look of the quadrangle ivy, the goofy dormitories, the bad food, the smells of the classrooms and those Hogwarts-looking buildings, it's all so tangible.
Good morning. Unfortunately, this is not a seminar, so I'll be talking. You know, the problem with teaching two classes, two lecture classes, is that you can't tell the same jokes twice. But given the success of my jokes yesterday, it's a good thing.
It's like you're back there again in college. But in the future, maybe you never were there.
This is a course about justice, and we begin with a story. Suppose you're the driver of a trolley car, and your trolley car is hurtling down the track at 60 miles an hour.
That's Harvard Professor Michael Sandel's online justice course. It does not require a trip to the campus. There are thousands of Harvard and MIT courses and lectures that are available online where there is no Ivy, but where there is a lot of interest in changing higher education. Harvard and MIT have a nonprofit partnership called edX, an online learning initiative that offers free online college classes to anyone with an internet connection. It's been around for a year and has already had an impact in vastly widening the access to learning. Anand Agarwal is president of edX and professor of electrical engineering and computer science at MIT. Kara Miller is host of the WGBH Innovation Hub program. Both of them will be part of an event tonight in Boston looking at coming disruptions in higher education. For a community where college is a major industry, the economy, Kara Miller says, is about to experience a jolt.
There is this really underlying fundamental issue here, which is the issue of money. You go to Harvard, you go to MIT, you go to Boston University, and you're looking at tuitions per year that are orbiting around $60,000. I mean, that is an issue. If you think about trying to put two or three kids through college with $60,000 a year tuitions, that is an issue that is motivating the whole industry, the whole education industry, to rethink, okay, how are we going to provide education? Is there a better way to do it?
Well, let's talk about the specifics of this edX joint venture of MIT and Harvard. I mean, they had a name in higher education for this sort of off-campus learning. They called it Correspondence School, and it was pretty much of a pejorative 20 years ago. What's different about edX?
One of the biggest things we're trying to do here is improve the quality of education. We really haven't had any big innovation in learning since the printing press. I think textbooks were the last big thing that happened, and that happened in the mid-1400s. Certainly, correspondence courses and so on got a really bad rap because they did not do anything about quality. What we are trying to do with online learning and with another form we call blended learning, where we combine online with in-person on campuses, is to really improve the quality of education while at the same time increasing access to learners all over the world.
I think the real question, though, is how well can you motivate people when they're in a class? And some of these classes are classes with 100,000, 200,000 people. There was a course offered in the computer science department at Harvard recently where 150,000 people signed up. But you look at who completed everything, who did all the work, took the final, turned in all the homework. Less than 1% of the original students who signed up. So that is the real trick here. That is the real stumbling block, at least to my mind. How do you engage the people on the other side of the screen?
Although this is something you might expect. I mean, there are benefits, Anand Agarwal, are there not, of people having various levels of experience with college content. Some people maybe want to audit the class. Other people want to do all of the work. Harvard and MIT get the benefit of influencing students regardless, yes?
I think this is the ultimate democratizer of education. If you look at the people applying to places like MIT, Harvard, Berkeley, the numbers applying are significantly more than all the universities can take in. With edX and online learning, on the other hand, everybody can come in, and if they can cut it, they can get a credential at the end of it.
Well, this leads us to a philosophical question, Kara Miller. I'm wondering what the value of the credential is. What's the product that Harvard is selling? Is it learning? Is it the lecture content? Or is it hanging out with the Zuckerbergs and the Winklevosses on campus? Maybe that's ultimately what the real product is going to be in the future.
Yeah, well, so that's the interesting thing. I mean, people like Andrew DelBanco at Columbia have asked this question, are we headed towards a stratification of education where you're going to have people who hang out with the Winklevosses and the Mark Zuckerbergs and have that money to do that at Harvard? And then you have the other people who are in these massive open online courses with 100,000 of their closest friends. I think the promise, though, is that, you know, you look at something like Michael Sandel, who is this famous lecturer on justice at Harvard. And the promise of these courses is that if you're in some tiny state school, some community college somewhere, and you have an okay professor, maybe not very good, instead of listening to that person, you too can be in Michael Sandel's course. Now, on the other hand, there's also, I think, a lot of fear because of that. You've seen San Jose State write an open letter to Michael Sandel, basically saying, hey, look, the people in our department, we can do a better job than some guy 3,000 miles away. And, oh, yeah, we're also worried you're about to take our jobs. That's another aspect of all of this.
You know, I think if I may jump in here a little bit, what online learning and ventures like edX are forcing us to do, forcing universities to do, is to really think really, really hard about what is the value add of your campus? What is the value add of bringing students into a classroom? What is the value add of the admissions process and the people you hang out with and the campus experience and so on? So I think this is really forcing us to think really, really hard. Where is the value that, what exactly is the value that campus provides? And maybe by focusing on that, we can do a lot better on our campuses.
It seems there's been a tension in higher education for years about the embrace of a more diverse student body, a democratization, and the sort of language of, oh, they're a scholarship student, or they're an affirmative action student, or are we going to see someday they're an online student? That Harvard credential isn't legit because they weren't on campus.
You know, I think it's very hard to say where the world is going to be in the future. I think I'm completely confident that it's not going to be the same as it is today.
And let me jump in here and say that I think it's also possible that we're moving away from the era in which what mattered was where your degree was from. It may be that we're moving to an era where people say, oh, John Hockenberry, you've taken a test that shows that you know how to do calculus, that you know how to program computers. You see what I mean? So that it goes more towards what you know how to do rather than who taught you how to do that. Because at the end, you took a test and you scored, let's say, in the 90th percentile of that test on computer programming. And that's what your employer cares about. I think that's a real possibility here.
Moving towards an actual meritocracy. Well, to someone who dropped out of college, that's very reassuring to me. Kara Miller, thanks so much.
So there you go.
Kara Miller, host of WGBH's Innovation Hub program, and Anant Agarwal, president of edX and professor of electrical engineering and computer science at MIT. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And finally, the mother of all disruptors in our time, you might say, social media. The idea that one's identity exists as a physical presence, the hi there, how you doing presence, and it exists even more powerfully online, where updating, interacting, and sharing can happen wherever you are. Well, that's a real parallel universe concept, and it's disrupting offices, families, school classrooms. You thought quantum mechanics was disruptive? Well, now we have some important proof that social media are disrupting the language and instincts of privacy itself. Katiana Jin joins us, 15-year-old high school student. Hi, Katiana.
Hi.
So when you say you're private, does that include posting your pictures online, your phone number online, your address online? What's privacy mean to you?
Yes, sir. I don't put any personal information online because people, they will call you, they'll have your number, and I don't want people having my personal information. And, like, other teenagers don't understand how dangerous it is.
And how did you learn how to use Facebook to manipulate its privacy controls?
My mom.
Really?
Yes.
Now, we would have to say, Dana Boyd, that Katiana Jin is an unusual student in the sense that she gets from her parents the idea that privacy is really, really important online. The latest statistics suggest that adults really don't know much about privacy online.
No, neither adults nor young people are really clued into the details of data privacy, the ability to control the data as it flows. There's a lot of conversation right now, so young people are learning from their parents, they're learning from their teachers, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're very sophisticated in what they're doing. So I'm not surprised that if, you know, her mother is involved and aware of it, then of course Katiana is hearing it from her mom, because that is a conversation. But by and large, a lot of it is, you know, don't put things online, don't put things on the internet. But actually, that's not what privacy is. Privacy is not just about control of information. It's about the ability to control a social situation. And I think that we get those things confounded really quickly. So when you see young people doing this, they're trying to actually have a way of controlling what gets out there. As Katiana said, it's a lot about, you know, how is she going to protect her safety? How is she going to make certain that she's comfortable with what she puts up? And so when young people are negotiating that, they're figuring out what is it that will allow them to control that social situation in a way that makes sense for them.
Well, we've been talking about the control of information all hour on this program. Dana Boyd is a research assistant professor in media, culture, and communication at New York University. And Katjana Jin is a 15-year-old high school student, as we've mentioned. There's a Pew study out, Dana, that really suggests that the impact of social media has transformed the ideas of privacy, both for young people and adults. What are you seeing?
So they have a couple of different key findings in there. One of them is that they're saying, you know, young people are actually sharing more data, and in particular they're referring to like age or location, this kind of information, than they have historically, which we've actually been seeing a lot across a lot of studies. Alessandro Acquisti at Carnegie Mellon has been finding a similar thing, and he associates it with the defaults. Whenever the technology's defaults change, guess what? People share more. But at the same time, what we're seeing is a sophisticated practice that's really, really innovative, which is rather than trying to control access to content by really restricting it all down, young people are actually trying to control access to meaning.
So you're changing the language, Katjana. Do you subtweet?
Yes, sir.
So what is subtweeting?
Subtweeting is like a way of vaguely talking about someone. It's usually when you're trying to like bad talk someone. And instead of referring to them by name, you'll refer to them by oomph, which means one of my followers.
And in your case, one of your followers could be a lot of people, right?
Yes, sir.
And the people that you're talking to know who you mean, but it's not posted.
Yeah, sometimes when you're together with friends, like you guys will all know what it means. And it's just the people that aren't with you that are the outsiders.
And did this occur to you to do, to kind of code your language as a way of communicating? Did you learn it from some of your, you know, friends online?
Yeah, I definitely learned it from some of the other people online.
And how do you send a photo that actually is timed to vanish at some point?
There's an app that people download on their phone called Snapchat, where it'll take a picture of you and you can set a timer on it so the person can only see it for a certain amount of time. And it'll also send you like a notification if your picture got screenshotted.
So you really have this sense that you are controlling your information. You may post a lot of stuff online, but you understand what category is perishable, what category shouldn't be posted at all, and what stuff should be in code.
Yes, sir.
How did you get so sophisticated?
I think it was just like everyone who started catching on, and then teenagers just know how to like have this coded language and make things really vague.
Now, I'm being, you know, needlessly coy with Katjana here, but she's describing a phenomenon that really literally is changing language, and that's something that you study, Dana.
Right. And it's a practice that we see whenever there's a difference in power. And so you often see this in political situations. We talk about it a lot in, for example, China, about dissidents actually using a lot of encoding to deal with the fact that they're used to the state surveilling them. Well, young people are doing the same thing because they're used to a way of people looking in, whether it's people within their, you know, classmates or peers, or whether we're talking about parents and adults. Some of the encoding, like what Katjana is talking about, is very much about talking about people behind their back. Some of it is just simply trying to keep adults out and in order to have a space of their own. And so I see a lot of this on Snapchat, for example, where you take a picture of something that's totally an in-joke. And so even if people see it, they don't necessarily know what it means.
All right. So, Katjana, do you have secrets from adults, from your mom?
Yes, sir.
And they're online?
Yes, sir.
And we could go find them, maybe. Only if we wanted to ruin your day, right?
Yes, sir.
So, Dana Boyd, what's the takeaway here in the sense that adults are lagging behind young people in their understanding of digital media? That we really kind of understand. But where do you think this privacy idea lands?
I think it really comes down to the fact that young people are actually trying to participate in public life, but that doesn't mean that they want to be public. They're not putting everything out there for everybody to see. And they're trying to find a way of managing in this world where media flows constantly. So what I take away from it is that young people are quite sophisticated, they're quite thoughtful, and they're not, you know, these naive children that adults often think that they are.
Dana Boyd is a research assistant professor in media, culture, and communication at New York University. And Katjana Jin, 15-year-old high school student. Thanks so much, Katjana.
Okay, thank you.
And Dana, thanks so much.
Thank you.
am totally distracted. Sorry, my Facebook page is like exploding. Must be because it's my birthday, right? Thanks for all of the millions and millions of happy birthday greetings there on my Facebook page, where, yes, I have a certain amount of privacy, but, you know, you can't control everything. There's probably something there that will embarrass me later today. Thanks so much. So we're asking you, Maryland and 27 other states allow police to collect DNA for those arrested in a crime. The Supreme Court thinks that's okay. They ruled 5-4 yesterday that it's permissible. We're hearing from you on all this.
This can free quite a few people from jail that have improperly been put in jail or help solve some cold cases. I think it's great, but under one condition. If the person that just got arrested is not convicted, that DNA sample better be thrown out.
Act like a justice. Weigh in. Compete with the Supreme Court. Don't let them have all the fun. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tweet us at The Takeaway or weigh in at our website, thetakeaway.org. Comment on that or anything we're talking about. And again, sincerely, thanks for all the birthday greetings. Thanks so much for listening as well. I'm John Hockenberry. See you tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.